Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. And Dan, this is the 49th edition of the podcast.
You want to do the intro on this one, Rick?
Well, yes. As a former relief pitcher slash closer or wannabe there in high school, Rob Dibble was obviously one of my favorite players. So, and I think it's appropriate that this edition is the Rob Dibble edition because he, like our special guest tonight, would probably have been known for his great hair had he not been so damn good at his job. And that is exactly the case with the director of basketball administration, Mario Mercurio, coming on again to the podcast, a friend of the podcast now. Mario, we appreciate you joining us.
Gentlemen, I appreciate you having me.
All right. Well, let's get right into things here. Mario, we got to talk with you a lot about how exciting it was to be transitioning into the Big East when you came on the podcast before the season. Looking back at 2013-14, what are your overall thoughts? What was your first impression of the Big East season like, and especially Madison Square Garden, the Big East tournament?
You know, as a first and foremost, I'm a Xavier fan, and I've been one for quite a long time, as many of you guys have. And to go through something like that was just unbelievably special. You know, to follow Xavier as long as I have, and to see the different stages of growth we've all kind of gone through together. You know, this year to take that step together through, you know, in such an incredibly new journey was awesome. You know, all the new arenas, all the new situations, to be at a place like Madison Square Garden, to play Georgetown in the Cintas Center, you know, and then to cap it off by, you know, making semifinals in Madison Square Garden, the Big East tournament, was just an awesome ride as a Xavier fan. To be a part of it as a Xavier staff member, It was amazingly challenging, and I think we all anticipated that, to get away with 21 wins, to finish third, again, to advance to the semifinals. You know, there's a tremendous sense of pride that as days pass and there's some distance from the bad taste to your mouth that the last game of your season often leaves, you know, I think a greater sense of pride for what we've accomplished has emerged. Brian Hicks, our director of marketing, already took the NCAA tournament banner down from the Cintas and sent it to the company New England banner that does all of our flags. They had 2014 on there. And, you know, I think as you look up at 2014, it's and you see that number representing the run we made this year, I think it's different than in years past. We had a young team in a very real sense, but at the same respect, you have an older player like Matt Stainbrook, a veteran guy like D. Davis, a veteran guy like Justin Martin. So many different people contribute in so many different ways. You know, if you think individually about each of our guys to a man in that locker room, they each can probably hang their head on one or two different games that they won for our team. You know, you think about James Farr at Alabama, two huge threes. Justin Martin's performances against game, you know, in games like Creighton, games like UC, Jalen Reynolds, you know, 19 and 16 or whatever it was, 17 and 16 in the Garden. Miles Davis, second career game, 17 points against Tennessee. Stainbrook against Wake Forest, Isaiah against Alabama, Brandon Randolph, two huge threes against UC. You know, Samaje, All-American, first-team Big East, and honestly, probably the biggest performance of his year came with two free throws against Bowling Green. You know, something, as you guys know, plagued him prior to that game. You know, he sends that game to overtime, and you almost forget it ever happened.
Right.
B, 9-1, 9-2 assisted turnover ratios in huge games. And, you know, a guy like Eric Stanger starting eight games. All those guys played such a huge role in this year. And I think, you know, Xavier fans, members of the team, you know, you look up at that 2014 with great memories as time passes.
I kind of wanted to cycle back to the first time you were on the show. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was 2 years ago. It was X still in the A-10. And you gave us sort of the rundown for you of how you put together the non-conference schedule. And at that time, I think it was three home high major games, three road high major games in your exempt event, and then some bye games to fill out the schedule. And at that point, you know, we asked you, how's that going to change as X moves into the Big East? Now you've got a year under your belt with the Big East. Has the philosophy changed at all, or is it just maybe the pathway to get to that end point is a little bit different?
you know, the biggest change, and we touched on it last time we talked, but it's bigger as you feel it, as you plan a new schedule. And that's the fact that you're dealing with less games. I mean, you are only scheduling 9 individual games. And years prior with the Atlantic 10, you were scheduling 11. You know, those 2 games have been replaced by conference games. So you can say that's basically a high major game on the road and a high major game at home. You're now getting automatically through your conference. You know, you're left with 9 slots. You have some things in there that are always going to be there. You know, you're going to play UC, you're going to play Wake Forest, and ultimately you're going to play between 4 or 5 guaranteed games. And, you know, the connotation with guaranteed games, I know some people feel like, oh, you know, wish we didn't have to play that many. Wish we didn't have to do that. Why don't we test ourselves and go on the road? But you have to understand those games serve a tremendous purpose. You know, they're used as stopgaps during very tough parts of your schedule, just from a logistical standpoint. You know, does it feed into an exam week? Is it at the end of an exam week? Is it your home opener? Is it your game after Christmas? You know, again, the logistical scheduling aspect of it allows those guaranteed games to be helpful. Additionally, you know, if you schedule the right teams with Xavier, we make a tremendous effort to do that. They can help you from just a sheer number standpoint. You know, playing teams like Bowling Green, playing teams like Evansville, as opposed to, you know, complete bottom of the barrel type schools with a 330 RPI, allow you to kind of learn on the fly, play a game at home that's going to prepare you for conference play, but at the same time, get a decently quality win. You know, we respect the value of the season ticket and the fact that our fans want an entertainment aspect to every game. And, you know, that's taken into consideration when we try to identify the right people in those guaranteed games. But ultimately, I just did that quick math, and that brings you to 7, you know, 6 or 7 games right there. You know, with only 3 spots remaining, you got to be really selective. Keeping in mind, again, huge, huge game against UC, a long time series against a team like Wake Forest. You know, what is the appropriate thing to fill the rest of those slots with? You know, we're always going to explore great neutral site opportunities, but at the same respect, when you play those neutral site games, you don't get a return. So as enticing as it might be to go play UConn at Barclays or you know, whatever it might be, NC State and Texas Stadium, you don't have a return coming back to the Cintas Center. So keeping in mind, again, trying to get great teams off of a series in the Cintas Center, not putting yourself in a position where you're going on the road more than you have to, balancing all those factors out is kind of the direction I'd say we'd head in. Philosophically, are we going to try to go with an easier schedule, harder schedule? Dan, I really don't think we would say that we would try to dummy down our schedule and go easier. This year's strength of schedule was 89 in terms of an out-of-conference strength of schedule. Overall, it was 26. And the one thing about that 89 was we went to the Battle for Atlantis again, hoping our path would be a little different than it was.
Right.
You know, hoping to play
Kansas,
Iowa,
Villanova.
And we played Tennessee, but ultimately, you play Villanova, you play Kansas in that final. It's a little different than playing, with all due respect to USC, you know, nearly 200 RPI USC.
Right.
Well, you're talking about the exempt events right there. That was obviously one of the biggest stories recently, is the changing of the exempt events. Orlando and California basically getting flip-flopped, I guess. Mario, can you just explain to us kind of what happened there, why the change was made, why you guys decided to do that? And I, as I understand it, you guys were being kind of proactive here, right?
Yeah, to a degree. You know, I think you saw us file a waiver in 2013 and play the Battle for Atlantis with Villanova. You know, that waiver is granted on the on the premise that you have no other opportunities if you do get out of that event, if you can't play in it. And, you know, quite frankly, other opportunities existed in 2014 and 2015 that allowed us to stay away from Big East schools. You know, this year is well documented. You know, we were signed up to play in Orlando. Marquette had a contract signed before us. And, you know, clearly we were the team that had to kind of be on the auction block looking for other options. And, you know, just through ESPN, you know, the Anaheim option was available. Coincidentally, you're actually not allowed to play in the same event twice in a 4-year period. And if you recall, we were just in Anaheim, but that event is actually rebranded. It's going to be a little different than the one we played in our last trip out there. So we opted to move to that. There were other opportunities. We could have done an event where we hosted two games at home and then go play two games at a neutral site. And I think that puts you in a position where you're inheriting some teams that the event controls. They're going to send to you. They're not going to be desirable RPI games. And it probably wouldn't have presented the challenge that a place like Anaheim will present. In 2015, we were supposed to be in Charleston, actually, and Seton Hall had a prior contract in that event, and we were able to kind of bump over to Orlando that year to kind of avoid that conflict.
Mario, can you talk? I know that it's a busy time of the year for you as you try and as this is the period where maybe a lot of these contracts and these deals are worked out. But going into next year, my understanding is the games that are set in stone are the Wooden tournament in Anaheim, the Alabama home game, which is a return from last year's game in Tuscaloosa, and the Wake Forest game. I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying that you expect the UC game to happen. Any other thoughts on what Xavier fans might be looking at in terms of the schedule next year? Or is it just too early to say?
You know, there's a lot of moving parts just in terms of times and dates right now. And we are trying to nail down a date with Alabama and trying to work through the situation with UC. And once those big chips fall, there's some other chips that are kind of in line right now to fall immediately following. You know, I probably wouldn't want to extend myself to talk about exact teams at this point. I do think we're close to be in a position where we can announce a couple more games, but nothing right now that's, you know, contracts out or anything far enough to really discuss at this point. I do know opportunity wise, again, it's all stuff to be very excited about. There's a couple neutral site games that we're looking at that if the dates work, would be just huge games for us that I think everybody would be excited about.
Mario, just with the shootout, we've heard a lot of different rumors around there. Is there anything new on that front? Is there reason to be optimistic that the game will happen in your opinion, or is there not really much that you can say at this point with all the moving parts?
You know, being candid, I think the sentiment on both sides is that everybody wants to play the game. I think there's grand conspiracies out there and tales of a huge divide between Xavier and UC in terms of how each side feels about this game, where it should be played, how it should be played. I really don't think that exists. You know, I could tell you honestly, Greg Christopher talked to their athletic director this week. Mick Cronin talked to Chris Mack this week. I talked to my counterpart there this week, and that's common for every week. We have a much better working relationship with those guys than is probably advertised. And again, the logistics attached to just one game are complex, and the nature of that game, given its history, you know, makes it even more complex. If you think about UC, and this is just kind of a great example to illustrate what goes into, you know, every scheduling decision. We have a different exam week than UC. We have a different exempt event week than UC. We have a different conference starting date than UC. You know, the non-conference period is 7 weeks. So what I just named you right there eliminates about 3 weeks right there. There's Christmas, there's Thanksgiving. There's probably another week to a week and a half where you don't play. And then we also have other games that, you know, are set in stone through long-term deals. So you're then ultimately looking at like a very small handful of dates as is. You know, let's say there's 15 to 16 dates that remain there, and usually they're going to be in clusters of 4 and 5. And, you know, let's say their side says, hey, how does December 6th look? Looks great for us. And then you take it to ESPN and they say, well, that's the SEC football championship, Big 12 football championship. We have no TV slots. That date doesn't work. And sorting through that, as you do with every game, is at times a nightmare. And I think the commitment we're trying to reach with UC is to say, okay, let's do this right. Let's pick a date that we can look at every single year where, you know, even the city of Cincinnati knows that on the second Thursday of December, you're always going to play UC, something to that degree. So we're sorting through that. And those schools have obviously had conference changes in the last 12 months. Both schools have had athletic director changes. And I think as all those items get navigated, we'll have better news and a clearer future ahead with the UC series.
one of the things we did, Mario, before you came on was ask the different message boards and people on Twitter for some of their questions. And a lot of different people threw this one out there, wanted to know if there was any chance for an inter-conference challenge. There's been rumors of a Pac-10 Big East challenge in the past. And beyond this, what impact does Fox have on non-conference scheduling?
You know, both of those questions are probably appropriately bundled together. Fox is as aggressive as possible right now. You know, it's an incredible startup to be a part of, to see, you know, a network not just kind of dip their toe into the water, but totally jump in. You know, other networks you've seen grow 12 million homes, 50 million homes, and they trickle their way up. You know, Fox went from zero to 90 literally overnight. They have a lot of pieces moving, but as the dust settles, especially on the basketball side of things, like, they're as creative as it can be. We met with them in New York when we were there for the Big East tournament, and they're going to push the button any way they can in terms of breaking the mold with college basketball exempt tournaments, you know, one-off neutral site games. They're going to try to put anything together to keep the focus on the Big East and the other conferences that they have a stake in. So nothing's been announced at this point, but I would say if you're a Xavier fan and you're looking at that, that's something to watch over the next couple of years, where you'll see schools in the Big East exploring some different opportunities that, if, you know, other networks have done over the years.
Mario, going on from that, this was a question that I had specifically because it's something that I heard Coach Mack talk about. I heard Coach Wright mention it after the senior night game at Cintas between X and Villanova. And so the question is, again, from a TV perspective, how is the league schedule determined, and what input, if any, do member schools have into the sequencing and timing of games? And the reason I ask this is there are a couple situations this year that were kind of weird from a Xavier perspective. First of all, the fact that X played four of the first five Big East games were at home, and then they were on the road seemingly the entire month of February. You also had a couple situations where X went from a home game on the Thursday. I remember the Georgetown game was a late night tip on the Thursday, and then you're playing, you know, Saturday lunchtime at Creighton. I think later in the season there was a Saturday to Monday. And then also just the fact that there seemed to be an inordinate number of games that occurred while the students were on break this year. I'm sure a lot of those things aren't things that you were particularly happy with, but how much input does X and the other member schools of the Big East get into trying to get those games scheduled?
You know, the bulk of the input is going to be black and white. A very slim part of the input is what you want. You know, they're going to ask us, and they already have, for next year in terms of what are our spring breaks? What are our building blackout days? What are the dates where, you know, whatever different dynamic plays into your scheduling realm as a home court, they take all that in consideration. Our building's pretty flexible, but if you think it's St. John's, Marquette, Georgetown, you know, those are NBA buildings, those are NHL buildings. You take all that into consideration, you mix the TV days into that, and you have a total mess. You want to balance out in terms of is that team going to go on the road three straight times, four straight times, four out of five? You know, our gripe, our probably biggest gripe with our last year's schedule was we felt like the second half was much more difficult than the first half. When you sit in that committee room and they talk about last 12, they look how a team finishes. And you know, when our eyes first hit that schedule in June, we said they're going to look at that and say Xavier's might not have as good of a record in that last part as they did the beginning. It's something we've identified. We asked them to work on it. And I just think when you balance out real and tangible issues like, well, this building is not available, you can't play on that day, that team has to go on the road, it just gets, you know, it all gets put in a blender, and sometimes what comes out isn't as clean as you would like. We've had those problems for years. God love head coaches. I think they're going to find a problem with every conference schedule that gets handed to them. And I would tell you, compared to other conference schedules in the past, even that gripe we had this year, there had been worse. And ultimately, you just battle through. You know, the greatest part about the Big East is, you know, ultimately, Team A is going to play the same schedule as Team B, maybe in a different order, but you know, you don't look at Villanova and say, hey, they don't have to play Marquette twice. We do. You know, it evens itself out better when you have the round robin format as opposed to an unbalanced format. So that's kind of the ultimate band-aid.
Mario, another one of the questions from one of the board members, RC42 East, wanted to know if the way that the selection committee handled the brackets this year has any influence on how X will schedule future non-conference games.
A little bit, and I don't say little to be, you know, to blow off that question. I think each committee does handle it differently, and as each year passes, you can sense kind of a point of emphasis from each committee, and I'm guessing that it's dictated by the chair. You know, we've been fortunate at Xavier to really have hands on a lot of people who have either been in that room or have an impact in that room. You know, Greg Christopher sat on the women's committee, Mike Dubinsky, our previous AD, obviously chair of the men's committee. You know, we've discussed it here before. We've had an amazing relationship with Joe Lenardi prior to him being the bracketologist. You know, he gave us that idea of the numerology that goes into it. Probably my most interesting conversation during the bubble watch days of late February, early March was with the crew that does the dance card at North Florida. I talked to those guys and, you know, just to get an idea of like what has the biggest impact on that logarithm that they use that determines, you know, how your resume compares to other teams and hearing those kind of things and putting those into the general picture and idea of what you do as a from a non-conference scheduling philosophy, you know, that it's all really big. When we were at Dayton at shoot around, I had the opportunity to talk to Ron Wellman, who was the chair of the selection committee this year. And he was very candid about our schedule this year. The first game he pointed out is he said, you know, the game you guys play, that's probably the most important game for you and the other team is UC. He said, that's a great game for both of you guys. I asked him very directly in terms of their emphasis about leaving your home court. You know, does he identify there's a difference between going to play at Alabama, to play at Missouri, or going to a neutral site game, you know, and playing those same teams. And, you know, he was candid with his thoughts about that. And, you know, he identified that, you know, some members of the committee would look at that and say, you know, you are challenging yourself by playing that absolute home, you know, away game as opposed to a neutral game. And he also said some members of the committee were just looking to see what's your intent. You know, are you trying to trick the process? Or are you playing a low major away game to say, hey, see, we went on the road? And that's kind of the attitude, quite frankly, we've always taken. Like, our intent is to schedule for a seed. We don't ever want our schedule to hinder our opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament. And I think, for as long as I've been here, you know, even back to the days of Skip, you know, that has been the direction of that schedule to get you in a position to earn an at-large bid, to get your team ready for conference play, but never, ever to be an obstacle or represent that you're trying to do something, trick the numbers, you know, use the RPI in your favor to just slide in without doing the work to get you there.
Mario, can I ask you sort of a sub question from that? Is maybe that emphasis on leaving your home court and playing why Xavier fans should maybe not freak out quite as much that the teams that X will be playing in the exempt event this year aren't the name brands that maybe Xavier fans have been accustomed to, because it does give X the opportunity to perhaps pick up some of those away slash neutral wins over maybe a, you know, a team like a UTEP or a Western Michigan that's on the fringes of the top 100.
Right. And, you know, to a degree, no disrespect to any of those teams. I understand, and I've heard some of the gripes about that event. I would be very candid and say alternatives to that event would be you're going to play 200-300 level teams at home.
Right.
And then you're going to go to Barclays and play a 100 level RPI team and then a big, big marquee game, which I love that big marquee game. Hey, I love the 100 RPI game, but that's suicide to play those 200-300 level games at home. We wouldn't want to do that, you know.
Right.
And I will tell you, the Anaheim Field, our exempt event, produced 3 losses this year. It obviously helped our strength of schedule, but we left there 0-3. You know, if you go to Anaheim and get 2 or 3 wins against those level of teams, you know, I think you head home, you know, head held high and say you helped yourself. You know, especially when it's that early in the season with a young team, you know, 6 key new parts to it.
Right, right.
A lot can be said about going there and putting those guys on the floor in a neutral environment and seeing what can be done.
Another question off the board from Ben XU. He wants to know if there's potential for starting a series back up with any teams from the A-10, or if at this point you guys would intentionally be trying to avoid that.
No, I wouldn't think we'd intentionally try to avoid them at all. In fact, it would probably be the opposite. Again, recognizing the value that the incredible investment in season tickets so many people have. We want names that people recognize, faces that people recognize. And I think there'll be there'll be some intention to trying to get those teams back through the Cintas Center. Again, I'll bring this up just because I know you guys and your listeners are savvy to it. One opportunity we're talking about right now is playing Charlotte in their downtown arena and having them return the game. And that's an opportunity we're not going to sign up to do tomorrow, but I think we recognize that that was a good deal. That's a team that's always going to be a top 100 level team, and Alan Major's a face Xavier fans remember, and we have a very open mind to playing those guys.
Mario, a lot of the other questions were focused more on the Nike deal and some of the gear issues. So I know that's a favorite topic of both of us and right. Of course for you. First of all, there was a lot of talk this year about Xavier potentially going to a black alternate next year for a game or two. Can you give us an update on that? Does it look like that'll happen? And if so, can you give us a little taste of what that might look like?
It does look like it'll happen. I know Coach Mack let the cat out of the bag kind of unceremoniously on a radio show. And it's something we are going to do. I know there's mixed feelings about the black uniform. I've always really liked it. I know some people feel like that's not one of Xavier colors or not part of the tradition, but, to me, when I think of Xavier, especially over the last 10 years, like the image that pops in my head is that front cover of Michael Perry's Xavier Tales with David West running down the court against UC at UC. And like it or not, that black uniform is ingrained in our tradition. You think about that era, the end of Skip's era and Thad's years here at Xavier, huge, huge wins in that jersey, 2002, 2003, you're wearing that thing when you beat UC. You're wearing it at St. Joe's in a huge overtime win. Even 2000, which it was a Reebok jersey at the time, the famous Lloyd Price steal. Those are huge moments that we all remember and think about fondly. And if you're a Xavier fan that isn't excited about the black jerseys, kind of grab onto those and think about how it played a role in our tradition. And if you're a fan of the black jerseys, you can be excited because they're heading back.
A follow-up on the jersey stuff. Paul Pesco from the board says, last season we saw the addition of the Nike design on the back of the jerseys. Anything new or interesting coming up in the Nike deal? He also added that he noticed Creighton had new jerseys in the NCAA tournament and wondered if anything like that could be a possibility for X.
Creighton's jerseys I'd give you a little more detail than probably anybody needs, but I know there's some jersey crazies out there, but that was a part of their rebrand, and it just shows you how long it takes to get that stuff done. From a uniform standpoint, they rebranded in August of last year, and obviously that jersey didn't get to them until March. Typically we order stuff 12 to 14 months ahead of time, not knowing what names and numbers are going to go on the back of a lot of it. And they just work so far ahead out, especially with, they got football to balance, and you think about all the different issues that they have logistically with their puzzle. So the Creighton thing was kind of funny to see how long it took. For us specifically, other than the black jerseys, probably nothing new that you'll see very visibly on TV. Brian Hicks, Greg Christopher, and I meet constantly about the retail side of things. They are currently reviewing some licensing issues, and one of the first or second things we talk about is, how can we get more Nike stuff? How can we have a greater presence on East Bay, greater presence on Fanatics? As we head into year two in the Big East and continue to develop our brand, hopefully that's, those are answers and there's some things that happen that continue to push us in the right direction.
I also just wanted to add, it doesn't bear on the Nike relationship, but I appreciate, and I know a lot of fans appreciate X's aggressiveness in working with, I think Cincy Shirts had a couple designs and homage out of Columbus, getting some of those, the vintage Running Man design and some of that stuff out there that I see a lot of that around Cintas Center, more than I quite frankly expected to.
And honestly, yeah, any feedback about that stuff, either myself or Brian Hicks, we love. You know, we're both Xavier guys. And if there's something out there people want to see or people want, believe me, there's not an email that'll go unreturned on those type of topics. The input that we receive from fans with that stuff really makes a difference in terms of the directions we head in. And hopefully no one ever hesitates to reach out. And if there's something we can do, we'll do it.
All right.
I mean, I just would say that just from what I saw on the concourses last year, that stuff must be selling extremely well for those organizations, because a lot of people have really taken to that. I guess it's the nostalgia thing. I mean, that's what,
right,
you know,
no
Mario,
question.
You and I going to the gardens back in the 80s, that of course is the branding that we, you know, grew up with.
No question. Yeah.
Switching gears a little bit here, one of the big topics of the offseason is obviously this trip to Brazil coming up in August. Mario, what can you tell us about that, just from an itinerary standpoint, and why this is such a big deal and what this allows, especially with the huge 2014 recruiting class come in? You got five new faces. What this will give the team a chance to do?
You know, as the idea came up, it didn't even occur to me at that point that this huge impact it could have, especially at the beginning stages of careers like Trayvon Blewett, J.P. McCure, Makende London, Sean O'Mara, Edmund Sumner, a guy like Remy Abel, who's, you know, obviously sat out. But as the days have passed, weeks have passed, as we've worked with the group handling our trip, like, it is going to be such an amazing experience for our guys. It's something you can do once every 4 years. We actually did it. Sean Miller's first year, we went to the Bahamas, stayed at the Atlantis, played two games, and the methodology back there was you do it to get the 10 practice days prior to it. That really hasn't changed. We'll use those 10 practice days, but I think teams have been smart about where they go and who they play, and have actually started to get a lot more out of the trips. You know, as I watched on Twitter last year, Rhode Island went to Italy. They were releasing PDF box scores of their games. You know, they were handling those games like regular season contests. And I think, you know, being able to do that, the record doesn't count, and taking those guys down there is just going to be an incredible foundation to build for those guys. We are going to leave on August 3rd. We'll fly overnight to Brazil. We've opted to base our entire trip out of Rio. Teams will go and they'll travel. You know, you'll fly up to Sao Paulo. You'll stay there 3 days. You'll bus, stay that next place for 3 days, finish in Rio. We're going to just kind of base out of Rio just for logistics, you know, make it a lot easier on ourselves. Bring the teams to us for two of the games, for a third game, and it's not done yet, but we're working to play the Brazilian national team, which, you know, that's one of the most organized national basketball federations in the world. They typically build, and we even told our guys this, but it'll be a game that you're going to struggle to cover the spread, regardless of what it is, if you know what I mean.
Does that mean we might see a Jalen Reynolds and Nene matchup?
It could be an incredible matchup, right? And then the fourth game is actually something that the staff of Wichita State told us about that they did, and it's an incredible idea. They called it, for lack of better terms, a JV game. And what they did is they allowed Coach Marshall and their seniors served as the assistant coaches, and the underclassmen, incoming freshmen and sophomores played, and you played against a team that, you know, wasn't one of the heavy, heavy pro teams. And it allows your seniors to kind of take that coaching role, to teach, you know, to sit in that chair for a minute and kind of understand, you know, the pace of the game, coaching the right way, talking to one another the right way. And then, of course, it gives a guy like J.P. McCure the opportunity to play 37 minutes a night and you know, get an opportunity very, very early to get up and down against a great team. So that'll be kind of that's kind of the format of the four games down there. And it'll be played over a course of 9 days. And if you're a Xavier student or a former Xavier student, you'll recognize the name, but Dr. Tom Hayes is putting together a class in conjunction with the trip, where our guys will spend 4 weeks prior to it, you know, a 3-credit-hour course talking about business in Brazil, meet with a couple of Brazilian CEOs when we're down there, tour a couple of companies, and, you know, it'll be a great experience culturally, athletically, the whole package.
Well, that sounds like a great opportunity for the guys. Hey, Mario, the rest of the questions we got were the typical silliness that we typically deal with on the message board. Anytime we do that, Rick, anytime we ask for questions, we tend to get a lot of those. But there's a rumor out there, Mario, that you are Italian-American. And the question was asked, what's your favorite Italian restaurant in the greater Cincinnati area?
I'm a pizza guy. I live in Mount Adams, and we have very limited pizza delivery options up here. So for pizza, I tend to go with Adriatico's, which is Clifton-based. Really, really a good pizza. If you're in that area, they actually have a brand-new restaurant up there. You might want to cover up your ex and roll up there. Awesome pizza. Pasta, and again, I'm going to point back to another Clifton spot. There's a place on Short Line called Biagio's Bistro. That's a Jim Brockoff spot. Great pasta, but the thing that'll bring you there is probably the best tomato basil soup you could ever find. That's a classic Jim Brockoff stop off. So those would be two good spots, and unfortunately you're going to be supporting the Clifton community, but we can all be happy about doing that every once in a while.
And speaking of great pizza, we didn't want to let this chat go by without mentioning the next year's Big East tournament in New York City. Rick and I enjoyed several. I think we went to the same place like three times while we were there. But
as did I.
But can you talk a little bit about, for the fans that are out there that maybe, you know, we've already said our piece and talked about that experience and how special it was going there. Can you talk a little bit about what fans need to know as we get closer to the season, when tickets are going to start going on sale, and what the importance of X getting a good showing at MSG is for the conference and for the school?
You know, I would even speak on it in terms of just beyond the Big East tournament. You know, I went to the University of Tennessee for the first part of my undergrad, and I couldn't believe what an awesome culture it was in terms of the fans traveling to away games. I mean, a Saturday where you rolled to Athens, Georgia from Knoxville, where you rolled to Ole Miss. I mean, those are memories you always have. And I would say, like, the one thing I took away from this year is that Xavier now has that. I mean, if you think about the away games in our conference, forget about Butler, which is a quick drive, awesome city, but going to a place like Madison Square Gardens when you play St. John's, Omaha, Nebraska for Creighton, brand new arena, brand new hotels around the arena. Even Seton Hall, you know, we stayed in Jersey City, which amazing view of the new World Trade Center. Those cities and those arenas, there's not a better conference in terms of big cities, bright lights, awesome restaurants, easy access for the airports. If I'm a Xavier fan, I have a little checklist on my refrigerator, and that's kind of my bucket list. Can you get to all nine spots? And, you know, you do that over a 4, 5, 6 period. Like, what an awesome thing. If you're a guy doing it with your son, husband, and wife, that should be a goal of every Xavier fan out there, because really, really good spots. Specific to the tournament, I'll never forget that first night there. I mean, like, that game against Marquette, the lights are dimmed. You know, you look around, you got 14,000 people in there, just the buzz in the building. Like, that's something everybody should experience. I mean, New York City, the entertainment opportunities you have outside of just the Xavier-related events. Kelly Leon and our university relations team, like, they did a great job beyond the basketball with Xavier-related events in the hotel. There's a community service event. That's something that, you know, I'm making my hard sales pitch. As people think about Christmas gifts 2014, you know, that should be something on everybody's mind in terms of taking your crew up there and having an awesome 4 or 5 days.
No, I know we completely agree. We've said it multiple times since we came back from New York, and we'll probably continue to talk about it on this podcast, how great of an experience that was. I highly recommend it. I know Dan does the same. Mario, you've been great with your time tonight. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast again. Thanks so much, man.
Happy to do it. Always happy to spend some time with you guys.
All right. We appreciate Mario coming on and giving us a lot of time. I think that was some good stuff, and at least gives you guys an idea of the thought process behind why they do certain things with the schedules and why they're going to play in this exempt event this year. Good stuff from Mario there.
I also just want to say, I mean, we can't really reveal what we talked about. We had a little off the record chat after that, and those of you that wonder if anything happens by chance with this program, as far as, you know, how they analyze the statistics, how they analyze their schedule, rest assured that the homework that they do is more robust, I think, than most fans would anticipate.
Yeah, whatever.
Just say that. So last week, the podcast, we were here with Snow, and it was during a period where Chris Mack had been heavily rumored to be weighing up his options for the future, flirting, I guess it would be fair to say. I don't know if flirting's the right word. But either way, there was some mutual interest about the Wake Forest job. You know, and we gamed out some sort of quote-unquote doom and gloom scenarios about what might happen if he left, and that pissed people off, apparently. But in any event, what is the current status, Rick, as you understand it now? I mean, we know what Brian said on Sunday or Monday evening, but what's the status as you understand it right now with Coach Mack?
Yeah, well, I guess first of all, I would just start off with, you know, Brian's kind of report that you mentioned. And I mean, it basically, and we had some people rumoring that it was moving in this direction, like Brian kind of mentioned, but he posted this, I guess, on Tuesday overnight. So it was Monday night that he kind of got this information after opening day that Chris Mack had told Wake that he's not interested at all. You know, the big news part of it, though, was the fact that X has reached out to him and looks like they're stepping up their commitment to Mack and his assistant coaches. They're working on some type of new contract and extension for Mack. Obviously, I'm sure that's being handled with Greg Christopher and Mack's agent. And they, you know, with the new Ask the AD segment that Andy Mack just did with Greg Christopher, he mentioned that him and Chris are in talks every day, not necessarily about his contract, but just that they've been communicating plenty. So I think you can feel 100% safe that Chris Mack is going to be the coach at Xavier next season. This recruiting class will stay intact. I think this is big, though, and it's, we've talked so much about the divide between the basketball program and the administration and all of that, but I think this kind of shows that if they step up and they legitimately make an effort here, there's no guarantee you keep Chris Mack forever. That's just not going to happen. And there's no guarantee that you keep these assistant coaches here forever. I mean, you want there to be turnover. You want people to be interested in your assistants. You want people to be interested in your head coach if you're a school like Xavier, because if you're not, it means you're losing. So it's not like it's a bad thing that there's been this turnover, but I think that they have a really solid staff in place right now that looks and feels more comfortable together than any staff that's been here since Chris Mack started. I think they've got things rolling in the right direction, as they showed last year with the 2014 recruiting class that they hauled in. And I think showing a commitment to them and keeping them in place with the momentum the program has following the move to the Big East and the nationally rated recruiting class is a big deal. It at the very least keeps things rolling in the right direction. So even if you lose Chris Mack, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Even if you lose Chris Mack in a year or 2 years from now to another job, at least you kept this recruiting class together. At least you kept things rolling through the first couple years of the Big East and you didn't set yourself back. I mean, you can make the argument that there's been things that have set this program back, and they've been kind of in rebuilding mode and scramble mode a little bit ever since that first year or two of Chris Mack taking over the program. But right now, I think they're just getting back to that place where they're on solid footing. They've got a key core roster built together, and they've got a good staff in place that's going to do a really good job on both on the recruiting front and on the coaching front. So I think that's the big news here, Dan, is just that they've shown the commitment to keep this group together and keep the momentum rolling.
Well, first observation, I think you said program, which made me wonder if I was speaking to my grandpa beyond the grave. So props to you for that. I think the biggest thing, you know, I read a great post on one of the message boards, and I apologize, I can't remember which one or who posted it, but it basically summed up my feelings, because the poster said, look, even if you don't think or you're not sold that Chris Mack is a great coach or the coach that's going to take Xavier the next step back to the Elite Eight, to the Final Four, whatever, the risk of letting him walk this year and the various attendant issues that would go along with it is far worse than keeping him around and giving him a shot to succeed with this group, especially because in order to get the kind of coach, the kind of head coach that you would want theoretically to replace Chris Mack, you'd have to make that financial, the university would have to make that kind of financial investment anyway. So that's my, so that I think summarizes the situation perfectly for me. No matter how you feel about Chris as a coach, or what his performance has been, or how much of these, you know, whether you want to attribute some of the issues in the program to recruiting misses or staff turnover, or if it's a Des Wells situation that's out of his hands, it, you know, choose your own reasoning. But there was a major risk here that if you lose Chris Mack, that you take several rather large steps backwards. And as you said, Rick, X is finally feeling like they got their feet on the ground a little bit, even with losing Samaje, which we'll talk about in the next segment. Now we're starting to see a couple recruiting classes in a row that are coming through and are producing some contributors. And when you look at this, at what the team has got coming in next year with six guys who should be able to contribute, a potential seventh, which we'll talk about a little bit later. I mean, there's a lot of good things happening with this program right now. And I really think to push X back into transition mode, into scramble mode, into trying to find a coach at this late date would potentially set the program back a year or two. And I'll just observe, Rick, we talked about the Marquette job the last time and how rich Marquette is and how much money they have to throw around. Even they struggled, you know, in their coaching search. They were involved with Shaka Smart. He apparently 11th hour backed out. They were involved with Quanzo Martin. He apparently 11th hour backed out. They were involved with Ben Howland. They end up hiring Steve Wojciechowski, which was not a name that people really had penned in for that Marquette job. So I think that kind of illustrates that coaches may have some dissatisfaction with where they are, but not everybody is willing to jump into a new program. There's so much risk associated with it that it's not maybe the slam dunk that if you're from a big conference, you go get a small conference guy and he automatically is going to jump. So I think it's big for Xavier. And I think, as you said, you know, it's a stability issue. It's a commitment issue. It's a rapprochement between the academic and the athletic sides of the university. And I think it's positive news all around.
Yeah, well, and then, of course, there was the news that came out, I guess, actually a little bit before we heard from Brian about Chris Mack, that Samaje Christen is entering the NBA draft this year. He will forego his junior and senior seasons at Xavier. First of all, he's projected the late first round to middle of second round. I guess I know a lot of people are, first of all, the whole idea of people saying this is all you hear is ready or not ready from people, right? I mean, when a kid declares for the draft, everyone has to weigh in. Oh, he's not ready, or he is. That's the dumbest comment that you can possibly make regarding what does that actually mean? Because fans' idea of ready or not ready has nothing to do with like where kids are actually going to be drafted. Apparently, I mean, Samaje Christen is going to get drafted. That's not. So what, I don't know what you mean by ready or not ready. I mean, I guess if people think he still has skills to develop, absolutely. Now, again, he is going to be get drafted. He has family considerations that factored into this. And, you know, he felt like he was making the right decision for him. I think here's one perspective that needs to be looked at. He averaged 17 points a game this year, shot a better percentage from 3-point range, though he didn't really prove that he could shoot the ball from the outside by any means. So I don't know that really helped him at all. But with Trayvon Blewett coming in, who could really score, and another year with Justin Martin, and adding Remy Abel, and all these things, I don't know that Samaje Christen averages 17 a game on next year's team with the more scoring talent that they're bringing in. I don't know that he necessarily has a much better year a year from now than he does than what he just had. So the premise that everyone has of guys not being ready is that, well, if he comes back the next year, he automatically raises his stock. And that's not always the case. So I can kind of see it from that perspective. I am a little shocked that Samaje left. I kind of felt like after the way he finished the season in that North Carolina State game, he didn't have a great game. We saw what happened with Tu Holloway when everyone thought he was gone after his junior year, and then performed poorly against Marquette in the first round of the NCAA tournament and came back. I thought that would kind of, Samaje would want to go out with more of a bang and really get that opportunity to show himself on the national stage and increase his draft stock. But the fact that he knows he's going to get drafted and has a chance to even go in the first round, I think was enough for him.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of breath is wasted. A lot of virtual type is wasted trying to come up with a a scientific determination as to whether a kid should come out or not, like really reasoned arguments being presented. And it's right. like
there's a rubric, you know, that, right. that you have to check all but the boxes for.
That's not really the case. You're talking about maybe a circle of 4 to 5 people who are making this decision. And there are factors to this decision. You know, you mentioned potential family issues. What about the fact that maybe a scout from, say, the Oklahoma City Thunder has said to Chris Mack, hey, we're taking your guy in the first round. And there was some sort of assurance given there. I mean, that's hypothetically possible. I don't know if it happened. Neither do you, and neither does anybody, you know, who's talking about it on a message board. So I think that, you know, we don't have complete information. One thing I did find interesting, and I don't know whether this is even a fair comment to make, but I'm going to make it anyway. If you go back and you look at some of the things that Coach Mack has said about previous players who elected to leave school early, and you compare those comments to what he said about Samaje's decision to leave, I found it to be somewhat more of a lukewarm recommendation. And I do wonder if this was a situation where maybe the coaches advised him to come back because they thought it was a better idea for him to come back, but Samaje, for whatever reason, made the decision that he wanted to leave. And I do – another thing that I wonder, you know, and this is me doing exactly what I criticized other people for, but I do wonder if there's a certain feeling that once you realize that the end's in sight, you know, it's the old senioritis principle. Once you realize that the end's in sight, maybe he just got to the point where at the end of the season, he's like, man, I really don't want to go back to class in August or something like that. Yeah. And that sort of guided the decision. And maybe the idea was, I'm just ready to do the next thing. And if that's playing in Spain for $150,000 a year, you know, so be it, roll the dice. So, I mean, I wish the kid the best. Obviously, I think everybody does. You know, it's a blow to Xavier. It's a blow to Xavier's opportunity to be elite next year, but I'm not sure whether it is. I don't think it's like a hammer blow that will keep Xavier from being a very competitive team next year. Love Samaje, love his game. He's given his best for the team over the last 2 years, but I don't think it's going to, this is not a crippling departure for Xavier's season next year, in my opinion.
Well, I do think it makes for an interesting dynamic. I mean, him leaving, that is. There was the question if there was the chance that this Xavier roster is better without him next year. And I mean, there's no chance of that. They absolutely would have been better with him. And this is a big blow. I mean, I think they would have had a great chance to be ranked to start next year if he comes back, especially with the talent they have coming in. And I think you look at it, it's like, man, it's going to be tough to get some of these guys minutes, and some guys probably aren't going to be happy with the role they're playing on this team next year. And it's really going to be interesting to see how Edmund Sumner, JP McCure, and Trayvon Blue would sort out their minutes, because you have a Justin Martin, a Miles Davis, a D Davis, guys who all had already established some type of role on the team that would be expecting to get minutes next year. And those guys would obviously eat into that. So I think that was going to be really interesting. Now you look at it and there is something to be said for balance. I mean, you look at this team and they don't have necessarily a go-to guy. It's probably Matt Stainbrook is kind of your top go-to guy. We saw Justin.
Who's a really good distributor. And that's one of the things that I thought was a weakness for Xavier down the stretch, is that they fell into the bad habits of the previous season, which is everybody standing around and watching Samaje. And maybe they'll be forced to do better at moving the ball and moving without the ball this year. And maybe that at the end of the season, come March, will lead to a more cohesive, better team. I certainly agree that they're not going to be a better team on paper at any point, but maybe instead of the way the team kind of calcified this year and got worse as the season went on, a lot of that had to do with schedule, but maybe you'll see a team that gets used to playing together and shares the ball a little bit more.
Well, and I think the five guys that you have on the court next year all kind of fit together a little differently. I mean, I don't think Samaje and D were ever necessarily the greatest two to pair together out on the court, because both of them were point guards, in my opinion. I know there's arguments about Samaje, but the bottom line is neither one of them were shooters or guys that wanted to shoot from the outside that could help pull a defender, a perimeter defender. So you had a lot of sagging off. And I think D playing with a couple shooters in the lineup, like JP McCure and Trayvon Blewett at the same time, or Miles Davis and Trayvon Blewett, is probably more ideal for him, actually. And so I'm really interested to see how D Davis's role evolves as the point guard and how his play changes a little bit with kind of things revolving a little more in a direction that probably fits him on the offensive end, I would think.
Well, we look, I guess there's also another departure from the program that was announced last week. Kamal Richards announced that he will transfer away from Xavier. This was really no surprise. I think, you know, even before his knee injury, the writing was kind of on the wall here, both in terms of the guys that Xavier had recruited for the 2014 incoming class that we've just name referenced, and also the fact that he just couldn't break into the lineup with X this year. So at this point, with Samaje and Kamal departing, the scholarship issue has resolved itself, at least temporarily. But you think, Rick, well, certainly we know that Xavier's been very active continuing to recruit. So there, we may yet see another defection, or maybe even two, correct?
Yeah, I think there's still some things to be decided, and guys making probably tough choices about, you know, where they fit in and if they may fit in better somewhere else. So, with as active as they've been, I think there's no doubt that we're going to see someone else leave, and you never know. I mean, it could be multiple. So, keep an eye on that. They'll be active in the transfer market, and potentially, you know, even a guy like Devontae Graham, who I guess is kind of next on the list to talk about, who is a really interesting situation that could be another 2014 recruit, basically.
Well, let's start at the beginning with Devontae Graham. This was a guy who he's at Brewster for a prep school year, correct? But yes. Prior to that, out of high school, he had committed to play at Appalachian State.
Correct.
You know, sort of a – and for those of us that aren't real familiar with his game, can you just give us the sort of 30-second summary?
Well, I think a perfect example would have been like a school coming in the beginning of Samaje's freshman year at Winton Woods, basically, right when Samaje was already good by that freshman year. I mean, he was playing really well in his junior season of AAU, but didn't get seen by a lot of teams. I don't know exactly how Devontae Graham's situation was, but going into his senior year, clearly, you know, he didn't have high major interest at all and hadn't shown that, at least not on the national stage yet. So he gets an offer and accepts it from Appalachian State very on, which Samaje Christen could have easily done if he's like, man, a team wants to offer me, it's my senior year, I'm going to take it.
Would be like if Samaje had committed to Miami,
right,
or something like
right away at the beginning of his senior year before X had even started watching him, you know, because they came in about middle of the senior year, I think, when they first started really recruiting him at all. And so he commits, Devontae Graham, that is, commits to Appalachian State. Season goes on. He just continues to kill it, continues to blow up. And he knows, like, at this point, you know, all these high major schools are interested, and he doesn't want to play at Appalachian State anymore. So he's already signed his letter of intent during signing day of his senior year, and he decides, well, I'm just going to prep another year, play at Brewster, and hope that they let me out of my letter of intent. So he goes to Brewster, continues to kill it in AAU that spring and summer, kills it at Brewster this whole year, played really well. And, you know, obviously all these high major programs are still interested, but Appalachian State has still not let him out of his letter of intent.
And if I've read the articles right, that's even true, although they fired the coach that recruited him. But it seems like there was some accusation that NC State had tried to had tampered with him after he was assigned recruit with App State, and that may be why they have been slow playing this to a certain extent. Either way, if they don't let him out of the LOI, Graham regardless of where he goes, he could enroll at another school. However, he has to sit out a year and then would have 3 years of eligibility. So it would cost him a year of eligibility.
Yeah, it'd basically be like a transfer. He'd just be doing it as a freshman and losing right. his first year of eligibility. So
it actually is more almost like a, like the Posey situation, like a, like the old Prop 48. 48.
Right. Yeah, but you could earn your year back doing that, right? Or is that just the new, is that the new Mark Lyons rule?
I think
that's
the new rule. I think when during Posey's time, you just got the 3 years.
Okay, Prop 48 was that. Partial qualifier is what I'm thinking of.
Right, partial qualifier, yeah. So where is Xavier in this process? Where is he in this process? And do we have any idea when this kid will know, first of all, whether he's going to be released from the LOI, and then what's going to happen with his recruitment process?
Well, we won't know what's going to happen with his LOI until Appalachian State either does something, or I believe it is like May 5th or something like that is when, I don't know if the calendar flips and he's allowed to basically decide he's transferring and open to other schools or what the case is there. But I think it's somewhere around May 5th is when he can begin contact with other schools, because at this point the relationship has gotten so ugly, he's definitely not going to Appalachian State. So Xavier is one of the schools that have gone to watch him run open gym at Brewster. They were there this week. But a lot of other schools have been in contact. I mean, there's people out there who think Wichita State and North Carolina State are the leaders. Obviously, you mentioned the tampering accusations against North Carolina State. So I don't know if they would even be allowed. Appalachian State could possibly release him to schools.
Like a conditional
release. Right, a conditional release and exclude North Carolina State from that. But, you know, Xavier is in the mix. I think they will have a chance. Obviously, they've got a great relationship with Jason Smith at Brewster. The Samaje connection, having a point guard go from Brewster and Xavier, and now he's going straight to the draft, doesn't hurt after 2 years. I'm sure Devontae Graham likes that. So I think Xavier will be a player in this one. It's just a really interesting situation right now. But there, I mean, Kansas needs a point guard bad. They're coming after him with minutes to offer. There's going to be some big time programs in on this one. I don't think it's going to be easy to land it by any stretch of the imagination.
All right. And then another player that we mentioned, I think, in passing on the last podcast is Ronnie Johnson, the little point guard from Purdue, who's decided to transfer away from the Boilers, and X apparently is very involved in his transfer recruitment. What's the status on that, Rick?
Yeah, well, I've heard, you know, I don't know if this is entirely accurate, but I have heard rumblings that UC and Xavier are kind of the two to beat here, which is interesting. We haven't seen Xavier and UC go head to head for a whole lot of recruits recently, especially transfers. And
it would have been the last one that both were seriously recruiting. I mean, X sort of waved at Kevin Johnson, but I don't think they were that serious.
Yeah.
Devin Williams, maybe?
Yeah, although allegedly Mick wasn't huge on him, so I don't know how hard Mick ever really was going after him. I don't know. They haven't been, put it this way, they haven't been the leaders for a kid very often. Now, again, I don't know. There could be some other schools involved here with Ronnie Johnson, but I do think Xavier is a very legitimate player here. They obviously need a point guard for that 2015 year. Samaje is already gone, and they knew he was going to be gone. You have a guy in Edmund Sumner who isn't necessarily a true point, but could end up playing some point. As of now, Brandon Randolph is still there. And after this year, I don't think we really know what to expect out of him. So adding a guy like Ronnie Johnson, who has already averaged over 10 points a game and played 25 minutes a game at the Big Ten level, is obviously a nice insurance policy for that 2015 season after D. Davis has graduated.
One other potential point guard option that Xavier fans will be sadly familiar with is Tyler Lewis from North Carolina State, who announced he's leaving the Wolfpack shortly after their season. But it sounded like Xavier initially was trying to get involved in this one, but it sounds like you believe that the Musketeers are not really a factor here.
I mean, I could see them taking Tyler Lewis, or at least getting him on a visit, showing him interest. I just don't think this is their guy. Ultimately, I think probably they could do better in the 2015 class and just go with a young guy, or even like an Edmund Sumner who's already in the program. I don't know that you're adding a ton with Tyler Lewis, although he is a guy who can really pass the ball and he can knock down some shots. So it wouldn't be a terrible thought. I just don't know that this is the guy that they're going to be going in after full force.
Well, he's got 3 years eligibility, right, remaining. And, and was a McDonald's All-American. So obviously a pretty talented kid, but we'll see how that goes. But obviously these are things that are going to be developing stories over the next month or so, as the Musketeers may be trying to add one more piece to the puzzle for the 2014-15 season.
That's right. Well, the other big stories in the Big East has been that Marquette job you kind of referenced in earlier, that they have hired Wojo, Coach K's top assistant. What were your overall thoughts on the hire? I mean, you mentioned it. This is obviously a place that has shown a huge commitment to basketball, and they pay their coaches a ton of money. There are a lot of big names mentioned for this job. They end up with an assistant, a guy that, as you mentioned, wasn't really a name that had been penciled in as a candidate. What are your initial thoughts on the hire?
Well, my initial thought is that this is a good example of why first of all, that Buzz Williams' departure was probably timed about as poorly as imaginable for Marquette, because it came during a time where they had no athletic director and they didn't even have a university president. They were going through the search process for a university president. I know they hired somebody last week, but so you had sort of almost a rudderless ship during this period where they're trying to replace Buzz. And to me, this is like Marquette is one of those jobs that ought to carry a lot of attraction for a coach like a Shaka Smart or even a Greg Marshall or somebody on that level, because this is a school that has won a national championship. They've been to a Final Four in recent memory. They play in an NBA arena. They're the biggest game in town in Milwaukee. The as we've talked about, referencing some of Rick Carter's efforts on the recruiting trail, they're right between the Chicago area, which is a great recruiting, which is a very fertile recruiting ground, and some of those upper Midwestern states, Minnesota specifically, that produce a ton of Division I talent, in Canada nowadays.
Right.
And they've got the blank check. They've got the wealthy donors that plow money into that program, and they can afford to pay $2.5-3 million a year. So it is surprising to me. This to me was like, and I think I texted you this just as soon as Buzz left. I'm like, if Shaka Smart was going to leave VCU, this seems like the ideal scenario for him. And so I was a little bit surprised that he turned down the job. We think he turned down the job. But yeah, Wojciechowski, I mean, I don't know. The record of Duke assistants for the longest time was very patchy, but you know, Tommy Amaker, after his initial struggles, is doing really well at Harvard. Johnny Dawkins, you know, had a nice run with Stanford this year, although I don't know that his overall resume is that great. Mike Bray, you know, has done good things at Notre Dame, although they've kind of fallen off in recent years. So is it fair to say, oh, Krzyzewski assistant, probably bad? The one thing that it tells me, though, is that Mike Krzyzewski is going to be the coach at Duke for probably is going to be the coach at Duke until he dies on the sideline, because I can't imagine that Wojo would leave Duke if he had any opportunity of getting that job in the next few years.
Yeah, well, and Coach K had just made the comment that he's going to stay for at least another 5 years, which almost seemed like a direct endorsement of, look, you can hire him. He's not going to be coming back to replace me in the next year or two. You'll get him right, for at least right. Five, you know. One of the interesting things, and the great Charles Bronson posted this on our board, was you looked at the comments that some of the players made about after he made the move to Virginia Tech, and he's obviously looked at as one of the top coaches in the game, a kind of a player's coach type of guy. And Dwayne Wilson says, as soon as Buzz left, I was in to stay. I'm Marquette. I'm going to be Marquette for the next 4 years. Todd Mayo said it didn't seem like we liked each other, and called it a change that was needed. Steve Taylor said, I was sold on just getting away from here before Buzz left. That surprised me a little bit. I mean, I didn't know that they were, it kind of lends a little more insight that, you know, people mentioned that Buzz didn't really like the administration, and there were some major problems between the administration and the basketball program there, like sort of like we've talked about with Xavier. But clearly there was some disconnect between Buzz and his current roster. And you look at what he was bringing back, it wasn't the most talented group. So, I think that's kind of interesting that he is kind of running away from this thing. I don't know how good of a situation Marquette's in right now. And clearly the togetherness of that locker room was not all that good this past year.
Well, the question that I have to ask are those comments just the venting of players whose coach has just left unexpectedly? Because I think this was very unexpected. Or was there something more to it? And I think time will tell. I mean, you remember when we had Joe Hughes on and he talked about Sean Miller's departure and some of the and the reaction of some of his teammates. And it seemed like all the guys at Xavier were kind of like, yeah, this was one that coach couldn't turn down. Whereas here, these guys are saying, you know, don't let the door hit you. So,
well, that's the thing. He left for Virginia Tech.
Right.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. So when you try to put some of the pieces together, I'm with you. You kind of look at this like, okay, this is sour grapes, or they're mad because they're but some of these comments, it's not, oh yeah, it was probably for the best. It's, I was going to leave if he didn't.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's kind of an interesting thing to say it for my, now again, Steve Taylor, not exactly a guy who's lived up to his potential. Todd Mayo, a guy who probably wouldn't like a lot of coaches when it comes down to it. So I'm not putting a ton of stock in this, but at the same time, I do find it interesting that we paint this picture of Buzz and everyone thinks, oh, what a great hire for Virginia Tech. It's going to be really interesting to see what he's able to do there, because that program is not in a great spot. And
well, it goes back to what, to sort of the same dilemma that Chris Mack was considering if he'd chosen to leave Xavier. Now, obviously the money issue is, it's a different money issue going from X to Wake Forest than from Marquette to Virginia Tech, but the destinations are relatively similar, at least as of right now.
Right.
Both of them are also ran programs in the ACC, a conference which has basically gone out and gotten itself some HGH in the last two or three years by adding some of the elite programs in college basketball in Syracuse and Louisville. So, I mean, it's very difficult for me to think that somebody like that Buzz Williams is going to be able to walk into Blacksburg, Virginia and get that thing turned around in even 3, 4, 5 years. I think probably what he may have been doing is doing something that Brian often counsels coaches to do, which is get out ahead of the posse. Maybe these issues were starting to take a toll. Maybe that's why Marquette disappointed this year. I don't know, but it's pretty obvious that situation had become toxic, and that locker room was not the best place to be coming down the stretch. It probably was a good thing they didn't make the NIT, as it turns out.
Yeah. Well, Dan, tournament time, Final Four coming up this weekend. It's been just a fantastic tournament. This past weekend was phenomenal. The UK Louisville game was the
tremendous.
The UK Michigan game. I mean, just
the UK Louisville game was, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a game played at a higher, more consistent level of intensity ever.
Yeah.
And I mean, I thought that about the Louisville UC game at Fifth Third Arena earlier this year. I thought that game was played at a remarkable level, but this game was just completely off the charts. I want to throw this question out to you, Rick, and you can, I've posed this to a couple people this weekend. Has there ever been a better three-game run in the NCAA tournament than beating a 35-0 team, the defending national champion and your in-state rival, and then the champion of the best conference in the country and maybe the best conference in several years in college basketball, as Kentucky's done? I can't think of one.
There's no better run that included storylines, I'll tell you that. I mean, the storylines for the Kentucky run has just been, when you look at all the insane amounts of like newspapers and quote unquote media outlets that cover UK for games, it's absolutely insane. Like, every little newspaper in the state from 3 hours away sends some newspaper reporter to every UK game because they want that season ticket to get what, because a reporter wants to go cover those games. So, I mean, there has been enough stories though during this tournament run for all of those little podunk newspapers to write something different. It's been spectacular from a media perspective, and it's been an absolute frenzy around this UK team and plenty of storylines. But when you look at the actual merits, I'm the wrong person to ask because I just can't remember back near enough I've killed too many brain cells to think about whether it is the actual toughest run. But for anything I can remember and in my lifetime, I'd have to say it is. And it's definitely been the most fun run to watch in my lifetime that a team has made, because this group has as much as they were talked about, and I think as much as they've been in the national spotlight, you feel like you get to know them better than a lot of other teams that come from out of nowhere and become these Cinderella stories. They weren't a Cinderella story because they had so much talent, but it's been so much fun to watch them come together and kind of look like what we all thought before the season they had the potential to be.
They face a very interesting national semifinal on Saturday against Wisconsin, who I think has been one of the most impressive teams. I mean, their win over Arizona, another tremendous game. Frank Kaminsky produced in that game one of the best games I can remember seeing from a big man in recent years in the tournament. I mean, he just and that's an Arizona on a front line that has like three pros on their front line, and Kaminsky completely demolished them in that game. So I think it's a very interesting matchup, and this may be a game where for the first time in these three games, the team Kentucky's playing against has some beef inside, and Kentucky may not be able to get as many easy baskets as they've gotten in recent games off of tip dunks.
Well, especially without Willie Cauley-Stein.
Exactly. So I actually think that Wisconsin may have I actually look at this game as a coin flip, and I think Wisconsin's got a very legitimate shot to play for the championship on Monday night. The other semifinal, I mean, UConn has just run through this tournament beating teams that I find way more interesting than UConn. I mean, I enjoy watching Shabazz Napier play, but I just don't. There's nothing about UConn that really like sticks out in my mind that I really enjoy watching that much. Florida, on the other hand, is just the last 6 minutes. I'm going to say the Florida Dayton Elite Eight game was about as efficient a demolition of a basketball team that I think I can remember seeing. And that was a Dayton team that was playing at a very high level, probably topping out what their talent could produce over their NCAA tournament run. Well, so I think it's going to be, I'll go out on the limb and I'll say it's Florida and Wisconsin on Monday.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with this Florida team in efficiency. I mean, I was watching this with a friend and we were talking about how when you're playing against Florida, if you have three or four empty possessions, you are going to be down by 8 points. Mm-hmm. You automatically just end up, it's an 8 point run. They don't have hardly any droughts where they go several possessions without scoring. I mean, they are so consistent on the offensive end. And you look at Dayton, I mean, their run was spectacular, not to take anything away from them, but they really were not a good defensive team all year. And you look at the kind of the way things shook out for them. They got an Ohio State team that couldn't score, a Syracuse team that allowed everyone to play in games with them because they couldn't score all year long. Things kind of worked out in their favor. I mean, they obviously had some great wins in there, but I think this Florida matchup was just one that they were never going to be able to overcome. So I do think Florida beats UConn, but UConn, it's amazing what Kevin Ollie has done for his transition as becoming the head coach. I mean, he has now put himself in a position with the interviews he's given after winning these big games and what he's done. I always talk about it. The biggest part of recruiting, the best thing you can do for your program when it comes to recruiting is win games in the NCAA tournament, be seen, right. Get in front of a camera, show that you and your kids love each other, show that camaraderie and clearly his team loves playing for him. I mean, I think he's come off as one of the more quote unquote real coaches when it comes to just, he doesn't give very cliche answers. He just kind of talks candidly to the reporters, and his kids really seem to respond to him. I think he's done a great job of setting himself up for a nice run here at UConn and keeping what they had going with Calhoun.
I wonder if the adversity that a lot of the guys in the team faced between Calhoun's departure, the year in exile, the conference turmoil, et cetera. I wonder if it did build up sort of a bunker mentality in that locker room, and what we're seeing over the last 2 weeks kind of as part of that, because it's rare that you see a team play Michigan State in March and clearly out tough Michigan State.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of one of the things that really caught my eye about this UConn team, and why, you look at the teams they're playing and they don't really intrigue you near as much as the team they're playing against, but yet they keep finding a way to win. So you can't count them out against this Florida team. I still like Florida to win that game, though. And then in the other matchup, I'm going with Kentucky. You mentioned Frank Kaminsky. He's been outstanding. And when I watched him as an AAU player, I always thought perfect guy for Wisconsin, perfect Big Ten big man, he's going to do great things there, but thought of him as more of just a stiff guy who could really shoot and really rebound the ball. It amazes me how he continues. It seems like even each round of the tournament, he's added new ways to score the basketball and shown new parts of his game that we hadn't seen before. He continues to get better and better, and he's been a lot of fun to watch. But I do look at this UK team, and while I think Wisconsin can contend with them on the boards without Willie Cauley-Stein, I still look at the amount of talent Kentucky has, and outside of Kaminsky and maybe Sam Decker, I'm taking UK at almost every other spot. UK's guards are really playing well right now, and they're so big with so much size. I think it kind of they're going to take away a lot of what Wisconsin likes to do in the half court. The advantages Wisconsin has of being the bigger, more physical, stronger team, like we talked about, and out toughing people, it's not going to be there against this Kentucky team. They're going to have to find other ways. And unless Wisconsin really shoots the lights out, I don't see them beating Kentucky. So I'm going to go Florida and Kentucky in the finals.
But I think regardless of who Florida plays, I think at least for me,
they're the heavy favorite.
Yeah. Whether it's trying to beat Kentucky for the fourth time, which would be pretty amazing, and win their 35th straight game or whatever. But what would be even more interesting would be Florida Wisconsin in that game, because I believe that Florida's two losses this year are to UConn and Wisconsin. So it would be kind of interesting if they had to play those two teams to win the national title. Either way, I think Billy Donovan takes home his third national title, and we all have
to
come to terms with the fact that, you know, a lot of times you lose sight of them because the SEC outside of Kentucky is sometimes out of sight, out of mind. But that may be the best program of the last decade in college basketball. So
it really has to be
to come up with a better one.
Yeah, I mean, Billy Donovan is on the Mount Rushmore of active coaches right now. He's as good as it gets. His run at Florida has been outstanding, especially when you consider the fact that it's an SEC football school.
Right. Well, Will Muschamp is converting it to not a football school.
Yeah, you're right. They're heading in the other direction quickly, as we found out hanging out with some Florida football fans in New York.
So, Rick, we were going to talk about the Reds. We'll just hold that off till the next time. This has gone on long enough. But want to thank again Mario Mercurio for appearing on the podcast today. Pleased to get kind of a look inside the Xavier basketball program. Always enjoy that. That's sort of it's sort of inside baseball when he comes on and gives us kind of a look behind the curtain, so to speak. And you know, we'll be back after the national title game, hopefully with a little bit more information about where things stand with some of these transfer targets the Musketeers are looking for. And then also maybe it's time to start thinking about that 2015 recruiting class and starting to bring up some names that the Muskies will be focusing on this summer.
Sounds good. Well, for the 49th edition, Rob Dibble edition, that is, of the Dana Victory podcast, I'm Rick. He's Dan. Thanks for listening, everyone.